Well, welcome to the annual Max Watson Lecture. I'm John Adams, Chairman of the Foundation for Law, Justice, and Society. More about that later. Henry Kissinger, academic and statesman, once complained that academic debates are so acrimonious because the stakes were so small. I don't know the validity of that comment, but I can attest that Max Watson, statesman turned academic, absolutely belies this complaint. Max Watson, who we honor tonight, stands in stark contrast to the complaint of Kissinger. Max was a highly respected practitioner of high-level economic policy. He was director, deputy director of the International Monetary Fund, economic advisor to the European Commission, and in 2010, appointed to the Commission of the Ireland Central Bank and advised them on the economic crisis Ireland was then facing. Equally, to recall Max is to recall his warm spirit, his diplomatic skills with all and at all levels, and his contribution to the academic life of Oxford and as a fellow of Wolfson College, and as a member of our foundation. It is with all of that in mind that the foundation honors Max tonight with a lecture given in his name. The Foundation for Law, Justice, and Society, affiliated with Wolfson College and the Center for Social Legal Studies, was formed in 2005 for the purpose of study, reflecting on, and promoting in various ways the rule of law in society, focusing on issues of contemporary interest and importance. A current project of the foundation is to revisit the idea and purpose of constitutions. In furtherance tonight as the Max Watson Lecture, Professor Galligan, member of the foundation, emeritus Oxford Professor of Social Legal Studies, and a fellow here at Wolfson College will present The Post-Populist Constitution, Reassessing the Place of People. Populist forces are on the rise across the transatlantic world. We think of Brexit, we think of Donald Trump, and authoritarian populists in control of Hungary and Poland, to name just a few. Authoritarianism appears as a rejection of the establishment and a challenge to liberal democracy and global constitutions. Whether the outcome proves to be radical depends upon the response of the establishment. In this analysis of populism, we tend to focus, I think, on the authoritarian figures and dismiss the people as simply parts of a delusional mob. Well, tonight, Professor Galligan, in his lecture, changes our focus to the role of people in the context of post-populism constitution, and I'm anxious to hear what he has to say. Professor?
Well, thank you very much, John, for those kind remarks and that very informative introduction. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. So I am going to, with the aid of a couple of 14th century paintings, going to talk about the post-populist constitution and some of its implications. Let me begin with the issue. What is the issue? When you look around Europe and beyond, something is stirring. Strange events are unfolding. Social movements of a new and unexpected kind are appearing to call in question settled ideas, practices, and institutions. They are strange events because unexpected, and because they disrupt the European post-war consensus of liberal democracy. By liberal democracy is meant, roughly, representative government and respect for liberty and rights. Some hailed it as the end of history, at least of constitutional and political history. After centuries of disorder, conflict, revolution, and war, European societies had at last reached a form of social, political, and economic organization from which suitable constitutional order followed. No need to look beyond, for there was nothing more to discover. The settled order and ideas supporting it are now thrown into doubt. New political alliances are forming, political parties are bypassed, the agencies of government, executive, regulators, administrators, even courts, all central to the constitutional orders of modern societies, are being weakened, ridiculed, even rejected. The slow processes of the law are regarded with impatience. Above all is the threat to the principle of government through representatives. Government by elected representatives defines the relationship between the people and officials. The sovereignty of Parliament, our rendition of the relationship, is pushed aside to make way for the voice of the people, the authentic voice of the people. Well, I'm not here to discuss the referendum, or the sovereignty of Parliament, or populism, but rather to consider the place of the people in the Constitution, especially in relation to the principle of representative government. It's not my purpose to prescribe what the relationship should be, nor to predict the changes that might result from social movements. My purpose is to reflect on how the relations between the people and officials have been understood over the course of British and European constitutional history, from which I draw four related but different understandings, models, theories, ideal types. The Constitution serves the practical purpose of declaring the rules of the game. By that I mean, first, it creates the agencies of government, empowers them, and sets the limits on those powers. The second main purpose of the Constitution is to define relations between the people and the agencies of government. But what is the game for which these are the rules? One answer, perhaps not the only one, is that the game is to achieve certain goals, in particular, to deliver to the people certain social goods, including security and defence, protection of person and property, provision of services, education, health, welfare, for example, and upholding the values of the society. Delivery of such social goods depends on a high level of coordination of the economic, political, and social dimensions of a nation. Coordination is the critical concept, the ultimate purpose of the Constitution. Coordination of a total society requires government, government agencies with adequate powers and resources. Government is effective to the extent it has the capacity to provide overall coordination. Government can be effective only if the people accept it. That means the people must exercise self-restraint in the face of government action. They must forbear from exerting their will and accept the will of others, the few who govern. Or, as it used to be said rather quaintly, they must dampen their passions. David Hume, the great Scottish philosopher, writing in the 18th century, noted, and I quote, "The governors have nothing to sustain them but opinion. It is on opinion that government is founded." Hume went on to ask why the people should submit to the will of the governors, the few. "The main reason is that opinion is moulded in favour of submission on the grounds that the few provide the social goods the many want." Hume appeals to the philosophical eye. But this account of relations between the people and government serves only as a starting point for those with an eye to understanding society in its historical setting. It is only a starting point, for a social understanding demands much more than active rulers supplying benefits to a passive people. For social understanding, we need to inquire more closely into the relations between government officials and the people. And that's my purpose. With the aid of some historical experience, I propose to draw out four images or theories of that relationship. Now, see if this works. In 1328, Ambrogio Lorenzetti finished a series of frescoes in the Palazzo Pubblico of the then Republic of Siena, the allegory of good government. Having established itself as a free state with a formal constitution, written in Italian rather than Latin, in large letters so anyone could read it, and a commitment to humanist ideas of good government by virtuous citizens, the governing body commissioned the paintings to adorn the walls of their meeting chamber. There they remain in all their splendor. What they mean or meant is much discussed and has stimulated a learned literature. It's worth the journey to Siena to see them. So on the right, we see, we just have to move. Phil? Yeah. So here we see the effects of bad government. Apart from the general degradation and ruination, bad judgment. Apart from the degradation and ruination, poor justice. I need the other one, the one I had. That's it. Poor justice. Notice the principal quality of good government. Yeah. Poor justice, wrapped in a shroud, lies in the gutter. On the other hand, if we go to the effects of good government, you see a very different picture. Everything in its place, the people going about their business, harmony and order prevail. But let's go back to the main figure of good government. Where's it gone, Phil?
Get it back to the.
You get it back to the main one.
Yeah, I'll put it on the full screen.
Phil's not up to the cutting edge of technology, as you can see.
You just keep pressing the right buttons.
Of most interest for us tonight is the central figure, this one here, Buon Governo itself. It is an ideal point from which to look back on what went before and to look forward to what came after. But first, the depiction of good government as it appeared in Siena in the early 14th century. The central panel portrays the citizens of Siena governing themselves. That is the constitutional point. The citizens are self-governing. No emperor, king, or pope is anywhere to be seen. They hover beyond the borders and before long return. But for the time being, their influence has waned. The old order of princely rule has gone, and with it the constitutional principle that the prince rules and the people obey, and in return for obedience they gain benefits. However, in the new republican order, the citizens have to learn to govern themselves. That must have seemed to them a golden dawn, the ultimate constitutional order. To capture the significance of the new constitutional order of self-rule as depicted, we need to consider what went before. It was one of princely or monarchical rule with the people under a solemn duty to obey. Princely rule was justified by the princes pursuing the common good, the good of the realm and all its members. In ruling for the common good, princely authority was practically unlimited. In order to rule for the common good, the prince had to have certain qualities. First, he had to be virtuous. And secondly, he had to take counsel from the leading figures of the realm, the barons and nobles. The prince not only ruled, but represented, stood for, even embodied, the realm and all its parts. So what kind of society was it over which the prince ruled? It was marked by stark and rigid social class, immutable hierarchy, leaving scarce room for critique or dissent. The common good, and hence the purpose of princely rule, was to sustain the existing social order. Rule was not expected to be active or innovative. It was limited essentially to doing justice by upholding the existing feudal order of rights and duties. To sustain such a society of such steep inequality, built on such unstable foundations and unnaturally rigid, strong rule was needed. The constitutional order and the social structure were well matched. As we would expect, to explain and justify the union, it was dressed in a set of fine ideals and values. Society is recast as the body politic, by analogy to the body human. Just as each organ of the human body has its place and its function, the same applies to the body politic. The social groups and classes constitute the body, the whole body politic. When they are functioning properly, the body is in good health. Most striking is the image of harmony. The body politic forms an organic whole, its preservation the purpose of the constitutional order. John of Salisbury, a 13th century cleric, in his treatise Polycraticus, memorably captured the sense of the body politic. To each organ, he said, a segment of society is allocated. The head to the prince, the arms to the militia, the belly, John's own word, to the tax collectors, and so on. You can guess where the people, the common people, end up. Denied a place among the noble organs, they naturally are the feet. Their function to bear the weight of the body and keep it moving. But John the cleric had an eye for sociology, for he went on to warn of the need to look after the feet. If the feet were neglected, the body politic would ignominiously have to crawl along on its belly, he wrote. So keep the feet well shod, John advised, for there is nothing worse than a barefoot republic. From this account, several ideas should be retained, for they will echo through the later history of constitutions and society. One is harmony, the notion that the constitution brings or ought to bring harmony. Good constitution means good health. Note the double meaning of constitution, the rules of government on the one hand, well-being on the other hand. Good health follows from harmony. A second is the need for strong princely rule. Even though the body politic is in good health, it still needs strong rule. For as John warned, disease, in the form of rebellion, is ready to swoop. A risk all the greater in a society of deep inequality. A third theme, the place of the people, our main theme, the common people, the people other than the elite few. What to do with the people? How to win their support while keeping them out of government and under control? Well, let's leave now that society and return to the Republic of Siena, to its social structure and its constitutional order. Among them, several things stand out. One is the absence of the prince, as I noted. The other, the early signs of social and economic change. A third, the appearance or reappearance of classical ideas about the nature of man and society. The people must now rule themselves. Society is still rigidly structured, but commerce and trade are growing, allowing the rise of a mercantile class, a mobility of labour, and a weakening of the feudal bonds. The founding of Monte dei Paschi, the famous Sienese bank, is imminent. In the realm of ideas, the humanist republican tradition is being rediscovered and revived. The Renaissance has not yet flowered, but the foundations are being laid. Ideas from Greek philosophy have re-emerged, and in Bologna the study of Roman law revived. From philosophy, the idea that association with others is both natural and a good in itself, and that the good citizen, by the practice of virtue, knows how to rule and to be ruled. From Roman law, the idea that a free man, unlike a slave, is the holder of rights, has juridical identity, and is not subject to the will of another. These ideas had consequences for the constitutional orders of the Italian republics. So let's just turn to this painting for a moment, the central panel. Notice the red and white cord passing through the hands of the citizens. You see, it's just very hard to see. Okay. It starts with Concordia, the figure there on the left. That's Concordia. And ends with the figure of buon governo, good government. The code represents the bond amongst the citizens. From that bond, good government follows. On that bond, it depends. Unless citizens come together in agreement on the common good, government will fail. In order to reach agreement, the citizens must have virtù, virtue. Virtue is open to many meanings, of course. Here it means the qualities necessary to know the common good and how to achieve it. Acquiring virtue in this sense is helped by practicing the common virtues, prudence, temperance, clemency, magnanimity, and above all, justice. And you see those classic virtues all paraded along there. The figure of peace, pax, is particularly attractive. The good citizen who practices such virtues in daily life knows how to apply them to government. I noted before some stress on justice. Notice here it is represented by two prominent figures, justice on the left and justice on the right. Justice is clearly very central to good government. On the left, civil justice, you see, justice being dispensed. On the right, a different kind of justice being dispensed, one involving the removal of heads. Notice the cord does not stop, though, with Concordia. It extends, notice, up to the hand of justice. Justice and good government go together, are inseparable. Doing justice, adjudicating rights and duties, is an essential element of any government. Notice, though, there is no mention of distributive justice. There are, however, risks in self-rule. Foremost is the conflict between private interests and the public interest. Each citizen has private interests to advance, potentially competing with the public interest. The citizen with virtue is able to know the public good and give it priority over private interest. The other risk is factions. Instead of reaching consensus, citizens divide into groups based on their selfish interests. Factions competing with each other are unable to provide good government. The fear of factions runs deeply in constitutional thought. When James Madison, many centuries later, came to design the Constitution of the United States, the risk of factions and the experience of the Italian republics, about which he was well informed, were a major influence on the form of the Constitution. The Italian republics of the period, Venice perhaps the exception, soon fell victim to factions and self-interest. Government by the people, self-rule of free citizens, turned out to be more challenging than the optimistic humanists imagined. The small republics either crumbled from within or, weakened internally, fell prey to more powerful neighbors. And with them, in general, princely rule returned. In relation to the three perennial themes we may conclude. First, princely rule provides strong rule, effective government. It waits in the wings to be recalled when other forms of government, here self-rule, prove ineffective. Secondly, notice harmony, concord, remains in republican thought, critical to good government. Harmony in society, harmony in government. They depend on and reinforce each other. A well-governed society is a harmonious society. Harmony is conducive to good government. If we just look back at the effects of good government for a moment, you see that beautiful harmonious scene of Sienese life, which actually is not that different today. But harmony is central to this idea of good government and a peaceful, prosperous society. Harmony easily slips into conflict and discord. Harmony is disturbed by self-interest. It is also disturbed by the people falling into disaffection. And that leads us back to the people. Who are they in this idol of constitutional order? Notice the cord of unity and harmony passes through the hands of only a select few citizens. Phil, where are you? Can we go back to the main one? See, it's just this group of citizens through whom the cord, they all look equal, they all look prosperous, they all look as if they have virtue. But what about the rest? The majority are untouched by ideas of self-rule. Some might have a say in who was selected or elected to govern. Most did not. Republican government was not ruled by the masses, not an early form of popular democracy. Only those citizens with virtue were truly citizens and fit to rule. And only the more superior citizens are likely to acquire virtue. So the tension in the system is palpable. Self-rule, being able to participate in ruling, is based on principles that apply to all. Yet rule must be entrusted to a few. That tension, visible in Buon Governo, runs throughout the history of constitutional thought. The tension is later resolved, or more precisely, attempts are made to resolve it, with the concept of representation. The idea being, the few represent the many. That notion is not present in a developed way in the 14th century thought, nor in Buon Governo. Yet representation in some elemental sense is implicit in this picture, this scene. In the earlier model of princely rule, you will recall, the prince is the embodiment of the realm. He acts as the realm, for and on behalf of the realm. That is a kind of representation. Not in the sense of an agent or delegate acting on the instructions of those whom he represents, but rather as standing in the place of the people and of the realm. The idea seems to originate in the church, in the way the Pope represents, stands for, acts as the church and its faithful. The leading citizens of Siena, those bound by the cord, in governing, must act for the good of the Republic and all its members. In that sense, they inherit and continue an unbroken line of constitutional thought based on representation. Republics rose and fell, but ideas of self-rule lived on. Princely rule, now reinstalled, had to contend with claims for self-rule, for some say in how people are ruled. The common people had small say in the Republican experiments, but were naturally receptive of and attracted by the humanist ideas. Once out in the open, those ideas are common property. Princely rule now had to find an accommodation with those ideals. But the tensions inherent in self-rule remain. If self-rule is a good, the basis for constitutional order, it must apply to all. Yet, that the common people should have a constitutional role, a say in governing, was unthinkable. As the centuries passed, the people became more insistent in their claims, the few more militant in excluding them, for several reasons. One reason for exclusion was the practical problem of government by the many, a problem deepening as small states gave way to larger nations. Hard enough in a small republic of Siena, impossible in a larger republic. Secondly, the common people were simply held unfit to govern, lacking both the knowledge needed and the disposition to act for the public interest. In the language of Buongoverno, they lacked virtue, although by the 16th and 17th centuries, few spoke of virtue. To these reasons should be added a third, one that shows the close match of the constitutional order with the social structure. Moving forward, during the Putney debates of 1647, not to be confused with those of 2017, of course, in the face of demands that the vote be extended to soldiers who had fought and won the Civil War, Henry Ireton, Cromwell's son-in-law and his brains trust, an Oxford graduate, rejected such claims with vehemence. Constitutions, he declared, are about property. To extend the vote to those without property, that is, most of the soldiers, would lead to levelling of estates and the end of property. A sentiment endorsed by his father-in-law in describing the property-less as mere breathers, a crude expression of a sentiment widely shared. Mid-17th century England, like 14th century Siena, is another vantage point from which to survey the constitutional landscape. Princely rule was now shared with two houses of Parliament, Lords and Commons. By the 1640s, the Commons was established as the elected house, a house with a direct link to the people. In dispute with Charles I, the Commons used its elected status to strengthen its challenge to the king's authority. The novelty of this move was not lost on the king. In his last exchange with Parliament, before war broke out, Charles conceded that democracy had a place in the constitution, not to govern, that was the king's duty, but to be a restraint on government. Coming from Charles I, that was a major concession. First, to use the word democracy as a permitted constitutional concept rather than a forbidden term suggesting the mob, and secondly, to admit its legitimacy in the constitutional order. The Commons' portrayal of itself as representing the people and the added standing that apparently conferred, like a card once played, could not be withdrawn. Notions of popular sovereignty, the rights of the people, ideas of self-rule, gained voice as the 17th century unfolded. Leading the charge were the Levellers, plainly a populist movement. Provoked by arbitrary and abusive treatment by government agencies, John Lilburn and his associates urged a constitutional resettlement. Popular sovereignty would be the foundation. The House of Commons alone would be the Parliament, elected by an extended, but not universal, franchise, and it would be answerable directly to the people. In denying accusations of advocating revolution, the Levellers countered that the sovereignty of the people was already implicit in the Constitution. Their language was local, but their ideas resonated with the humanist thought that I've just been describing, the humanist thought to later reach its apex in the Renaissance. Representation on this account has a place, but not the abstract notion of embodying the realm, Representation on the levelers' view now meant acting on the instructions and doing the will of the people. Not quite the rampant popular democracy that Charles abhorred and feared, but way beyond that discreet concession he had allowed. Well, the levelers' proposals came to nothing. For a few brief hours in St. Mary's Church, Putney, on Thursday the 28th of October 1647, there was a chance the High Council of the Model Army, the effective government, would adopt it. Until, that is, Henry Ireton delivered the coup de grace, the one I've mentioned. Constitutions are about property, not self-government. The agreement of the people, the document setting out a new constitutional settlement, was referred to a committee, and you can guess the rest, from which it never re-emerged. Well, the rest is history. The king was executed, but under another name, princely rule was restored. Ideas, however, do not die with dictators. Over the next two centuries and more, the battle lines were drawn in England between self-rule of the people on the one side, representative rule on the other side. Finally, in the mid-18th century, partly under pressure from popular movements, populist movements perhaps, the Commons reviewed the relationship. It did so with a seriousness of purpose not seen since, with figures like Burke, Pitt, Fox, and many others leading the debate. The outcome was not predetermined, and but for the spectacle of the mob rampaging through the streets of Paris, chopping off heads, the result might have been different, but it was not. Parliament took fright and settled for representative rule. It was a particular version of representative rule. Parliament is elected, they said, but once elected, it represents the whole people. Indeed, its decisions are deemed to be those of the people. Notice the as-if approach again. When we are assembled in Parliament, the representatives declared, the whole people are here assembled. Just as an actor becomes the character, the House of Commons becomes the people. The people in an abstract corporate sense. The real people, the flesh and blood people, have a vote, but otherwise are out in the constitutional cold. In cementing representative rule as the ultimate resolution of the problem of the people, the House of Commons set the standard and provided the blueprint for modern constitutional orders. In formulating the Constitution of the United States, once again James Madison changed the names, but in essence adopted the House of Commons position. Representative rule, much in the form described, has become the standard form for the majority of nations still today. Constitutional texts often proclaim and celebrate we the people, but on examination, the people are largely absent, except in the abstract way mentioned. So far, we have three approaches, three models of the people in the Constitution. Rule by the prince, where the people simply obey. Self-rule, where the people rule themselves. And representative rule, where the few rule the many. The last being the model, as I said, of modern constitutional orders. We have seen the ideas explaining and justifying each model. While they differ in critical ways, they share some common ground, some common themes. Let me mention them. One, effective government must be either rule by the prince or rule by the few. They're the two options. Another is that the constitutional order, to be effective, must cultivate harmony, concord, not discord, disharmony. A third, the lingering idea that the people ought to be self-ruling. That, after all, is the premise of democracy, rule by the demos itself. Yet the people cannot, in any practical sense, be self-ruling. So, representative rule is the solution, providing effective government while giving some limited place to the people. And despite the efforts to justify representative rule, it remains an unstable resolution. It is contingent on the people acquiescing, and that depends on whether, in their opinion, they gain adequate benefits from the system. Now, supposing we were to reconsider and indeed overturn those two pillars of constitutional thought, the need for harmony and the aspiration of self-rule. As to harmony, while the members of a contemporary society share some common interests, aims, and values, much of social life is an arena of competing interests, aims, and values. The common good is not so much set in advance, but is whatever results from the accommodation and compromise of competing interests. In place of harmony and consensus, an uneasy equilibrium is the best to hope for. But surely that is a true reflection of a society marked by division, fragmentation, diversity, than a dubious claim of harmony and concord. History is again illuminating. Although the discourse of organic harmony has dominated, there is another line of thought, another way of viewing society and the aims of the Constitution. Niccolò Machiavelli, the sage of 15th century Florence, was an early exponent. Machiavelli turned to republican Rome to learn the secrets of good government. He wrote, "Good examples proceed from good education. Good education proceeds from good laws. And good laws proceed from those very tumults which many so inconsiderately condemn. Public protest, dissent, discord, disorder, and strife are the weapons of the people, the plebs against the rulers, the patricians. These were the means to bring about moderate and measured government," according to Machiavelli. Machiavelli opens the way for a different mode of thought, a different way of viewing constitutions. It assumes a society of clashing interests and yet provides the means for effective government. Applied to contemporary society, this approach exposes the false consensus that liberal order cultivates and on which it depends. The alternative approach forces us to look beyond the calm neutrality of the rule of law, the juridical sense of equality. It forces us to confront the social and material world, a world of deep inequality. The aim is not to remove inequality, an impossible task, but rather to ensure competing interests are acknowledged and an accommodation reached to the reasonable satisfaction of all, a formidable but pressing undertaking. The task of the Constitution, then, is to provide the rules, the processes, and the agencies through which accommodation and compromise can be achieved. Many aspects of the constitutional legal order of European societies are directed at doing just that, but plainly not enough to address the concerns of the disaffected and to encourage them to play a more active part in those processes. Turning now to the second pillar of constitutional thought, the aspiration of self-rule. The other part of this alternative model of constitutional order and the place of the people concerns the aspiration of self-rule. Self-rule, remember, follows from each member of society being a right holder. being entitled to receive a certain kind of equal concern and respect, as Ronald Dworkin, our former head of professor of jurisprudence, used to put it. Giambattista Vico, the 18th century sage of Naples, not Florence, expressed the same idea in the concept of juridical equality and proclaimed it to be, rightly, in my opinion, the foundation of European constitutional thought. The revivers of Roman law in medieval Europe argued that an integral aspect of juridical quality is self-rule. If you are not self-ruling, they argued, you are no better than a slave, which status is incompatible with juridical equality. This, I suggest, is a false argument. Put shortly, one may accept rule by others without thereby losing one's juridical status as a rights holder, without becoming a slave. We may now sigh with a deep sigh of constitutional relief. The need to frame the constitutional order around self-rule, to squeeze all constitutional issues into that basket, is no longer necessary once we understand the position of self-rule. Nor is it necessary to keep up the pretense that we, the people, are in charge. Thomas Hobbes, whom I don't normally find I have much in common with, used to mock the democratical gentleman. Isn't that a beautiful example? He used to mock the democratical gentleman for misreading Roman history and misunderstanding the nature of good government and how to achieve it. And on that, I agree with him. A few final points. The position I am proposing, this way of understanding constitutions and the place of the people, this fourth model, is not anti the people, or it may seem like that at first. It is not anti-democratic. On the contrary, the people are at the core of this model, the aim being to make sure they are able both to influence government and control it. It is to add to and strengthen the people's position, not the contrary. People still elect representatives, but they do much more. They have the means, the processes, the institutions to scrutinize the actions of representatives and officials and to call them to account. Scrutiny and accountability are the critical concepts. Secondly, let's make passing reference to another well-known constitutional theorist, William Shakespeare. In the second part of the contention, Henry VI, Part 2, the disgraced Duchess Eleonora paraded through the streets of London in humble weeds before distant exile to a nunnery, laments to her husband, one of the most powerful men in the land, previously. She says, "Look how they gaze. See how the giddy multitude do point and nod their heads and throw their eyes on thee. Ah, Gloucester, hide thee from their hateful looks." The gaze of the people, a few words eloquently capture one of the keys to good government. Keep them under your gaze. Nothing is more hated by the wielders of power than to be kept under the gaze of the people. Find ways and means for keeping representatives and officials under scrutiny and account. Finally, this view of constitutions, of constitutional order, is not wishful thinking. It is, I suggest, a way, a model of making sense of much of what now takes place in the modern constitutional legal order. But it can be extended. So to conclude, if I were asked by governments how to cope with populist claims, an unlikely event, I would advise along the two lines proposed. One, extend and improve the scope for groups and interests to compete in the political arena and to have their claims adequately considered. The other, open yourself to the gaze of the people. If asked by populist groups, again an unlikely event, I'm not sure what I would do, but I thought I would give them a copy of Buon Governo and ask them to read this lecture. Thank you.
That's it. That's the end.
Well, thank you very much, Dennis, for an enlightened and lively lecture, bringing in this painting once again. I think that Professor Galligan has exhausted his sense of this topic, and unless there are any penetrating questions, I would like to thank him, and we can move on this evening. Thank you, Professor.